We began SN1, no, we didn't begin SN1. We began SN2 chemistry last time. We need to talk about SN1 today, but there was one aspect of SN2 chemistry that we ran out of time to discuss last time, and that's about the type of solvent used in SN2 reactions. So we need to talk about what is a polar aprotic solvent. So, aprotic means having no easily removable protons. So, it's non-acidic. It also, to some degree, is associated with this idea that whatever protons you have are unlikely to undergo hydrogen bonding. And let's discuss for a moment why aprotic solvents are the best choice of solvents for SN2 reactions. Because think about what the mechanism of an SN2 reaction is. The nucleophile goes charging through solution, attacks the substrate, kicks off the leaving group at the same time that that nucleophile comes in. Well, that nucleophile does have to make it through the solvent. And so what if you had a solvent that interacted a lot with that nucleophile? Well, it could prevent the nucleophile from being able to attack. So, for example, if you talk about order of reactivity of nucleophiles, we did discuss a little bit about polarizability versus basicity, right? Well, let me ask first, has anybody read the SN2 chapter yet? So, out of the halogens, fluorine, chlorine, bromine, or iodine, which one would you say should be more reactive? Iodine, in terms of polarizability. But what does the solvent have as far as an influence on that reactivity, or does it? So what is the effect that solvents have? But because fluorine is basic, does that mean it's a better nucleophile or a worse nucleophile if solvent effects weren't there? In fact, does anybody have their text? Because I want to point out this section in the text. Because this is, if anybody's using past notes, we didn't really get into solvent effects before. So this is on. The first discussion of solvent, at least, is, oh darn, where'd it go? Page 341. And actually, the top of page 341 has this diagram. It says that fluorine in an aprotic solvent actually ends up being the better nucleophile. In this case, because of fluorine's basicity, the fact that you do have that tightly compacted negative charge. But it has decreasing nucleophilicity for fluorine if you're in a protic solvent. So a minute ago, someone was starting to talk about fluorine or these other ions being surrounded by a solvent. Let's say we took an extreme case like water. Well, water can fairly easily surround the fluoride ion because the fluoride ion is not very large in comparison. If you have a big iodine, though, then it's harder for the water molecules to be able to surround it and prevent that iodine from reacting. So when you're comparing just the halogens, it does turn out, yes, polarizability does matter, but that argument usually comes up when you're comparing two different nucleophiles that have identical structures, the only difference being whether you have something like an oxygen or a sulfur. And so we talked about that example last time when we were talking about nucleophiles. For halogens themselves, fluoride being the tighter negative charge, amongst those four halogens, it's normally supposed to be the better nucleophile. But depending on the solvent that you use, that nucleophilicity can change. So what I've drawn here is what's sometimes referred to as a solvent cage, or it's sometimes referred to as a solvation sphere. Solvation is the process of surrounding something with a solvent. So a small ion like fluorine easily gets surrounded by the solvent, which prevents it from reacting with the substrate as easily. Small, compact ions like fluorine, gesundheit, can easily be surrounded, particularly by protic solvents. Things that would have these hydrogens that could have some kind of interaction with something like fluorine. So small compact ions like fluorine can easily be surrounded by protic solvents, which can interfere with fluorine being able to attack a substrate in an SN2 reaction. So if we list the four main halogens, it turns out that increasing nucleophilicity is towards fluorine, again, if we're not in one of these protic solvents. But if we did have a protic solvent, which is going to interfere with that nucleophile's approach, well, then that's why we have the reverse trend, where iodine becomes more nucleophilic because it's not as trapped by the solvent. Now, there are two good examples of polar aprotic solvents, and we'll get into the polar aspect maybe in our next lecture. But focusing on the protic part of it, two good solvents are DMSO, which stands for dimethyl sulfoxide. Which looks kind of like acetone. Except that it has sulfur at the junction with the oxygen instead of having a carbon. Note the lone pair that is there. That is a very frequently missed part of the structure, the lone pair on sulfur. DMSO actually has some interesting properties, which I've never tested, because DMSO does have some toxicity towards it. But apparently it so well absorbs into the skin that a trick apparently that you can pull is if you get a little garlic or onion or something like that, rub it on the skin, put some DMSO in it, supposedly you can taste it because that's pulled through the skin and ends up in your tongue. Now, I don't know if that's just a story that we learned back when we took chemistry. Like I said, I've never attempted it, but it is very true that DMSO is very readily absorbed through the skin, so you have to be somewhat careful for that reason when you use it. Another very common polar aprotic solvent, DMF, which stands for dimethyl sulfoxide. formamide, or formamide. An amide, that's a functional group that we haven't covered yet. That is a derivative of a carboxylic acid. So carboxylic acids, I think we know, because that was probably the first functional group we talked about way back at the beginning of the quarter. So carboxylic acid is a carbonyl with an OH group hanging off of it. If you replace that OH group with a nitrogen, that's an amide. Now, formamide is a one carbon compound. That name comes from formic acid, which that name comes from formica, which is Latin for ant. So the compound that does that, it's partly responsible for the sting of some ants, formic acid, for which formaldehyde, which some of you might have used, comes from. Formaldehyde would be, instead of a nitrogen being there, having a hydrogen there instead. Dimethyl formamide means an amide where you've put two methyl groups on the nitrogen. And technically, I should have squeezed this in here, the name is N, N dash dimethyl formamide, showing that the two methyl groups are on nitrogen instead of being on a carbon. It's the first time you'll have ever seen nomenclature like that, because we haven't been substituting heteroatoms yet. But two very, very, very common lab solvents. What we're going to soon start worrying about is when we write out a reaction, and not a mechanism per se, but just showing synthetically what's going on in a reaction, soon you are going to be responsible for knowing solvents. So for an SN2 reaction, a safe answer always to give for right now for a solvent, DMF. Very common, very inexpensive, works well for SN2 reactions. So something like water, ethanol, other things that have protons that can undergo extensive hydrogen bonding, those would make very poor solvents. So water, alcohols, carboxylic acids would be about as bad of a thing you could use as a solvent, because remember that many nucleophiles are bases. So, in fact, that is one of these more subtle points that we need to cover once we're done with this formal introduction. That when you're doing reactions, you've got to be careful of solvent, because if you take something that's super, super, super duper basic, what if it reacts with the solvent itself? But we'll get that into that a bit later. So this is our fourth of those four factors that we started discussing on Monday. We had substrate, which, just to summarize, for SN2 reactions, primary substrates are better than tertiary because of what two-word property? Steric hindrance. There's less steric hindrance in a primary group than a tertiary, so primaries react. We talked about different nucleophiles. And what makes a good nucleophile for an SN2 reaction? What type of nucleophiles do we tend to have? Basic nucleophiles. They need to be good nucleophiles, meaning they need to want to attack a positive charge, but many of the good nucleophiles are basic. What about leaving groups? We identified a couple of different leaving groups. And what are good leaving groups? Conjugate bases of strong acids, so things that wouldn't want to turn right around and react as soon as they get kicked off. And now here's the fourth aspect, which is that you want to use polar aprotic solvents, which we've discussed the aprotic part of it. Having something that's aprotic, meaning it won't react, or not react, but interact with the nucleophile. We'll come back later and make a reaction coordinate diagram argument for why having a polar solvent helps. Let me do one more little bit of review, which is to go over the six aspects of this reaction. That SN2 reactions in general are used to convert mostly alkyl halides to some other group, usually an alcohol or an ether. These, we already talked about the types of nucleophiles. Those are the reagents that we would use. the conditions would be to use a polar aprotic solvent. This reaction occurs with inversion of configuration, and it is regio-specific because the attack only occurs where the leaving group is.
What do they have in common so they become a good solvent?
Why are they both good? Well, they're polar, so having a sulfur-oxygen bond or the carbonyl, those are both relatively polar bonds compared to something that's just a plain hydrocarbon. And none of the hydrogens on there are acidic, and none of the hydrogens are likely to undergo hydrogen bonding because we only have methyl groups on that first solvent, carbon-hydrogen bond not very polarized. And on that other one, again, we have methyl groups on the nitrogen. Those aren't acidic almost at all. And then we haven't discussed hydrogens connected to... Oh, yes, we have a little bit. We talked about the hybridization effect on acidity, that a hydrogen on an alkane is less acidic than a hydrogen on an alkene is less acidic than a hydrogen on an alkyne. But if you wanted to think of that carbon-oxygen bond being like a carbon-carbon double bond, you would still say that hydrogen there is not really acidic at all. So that's why those both good make good solvents. No, it doesn't mean they're basic. In fact, formamid won't be basic because that lone pair is involved too much in conjugation with the carbonyl. And then DMSO is not really basic. Lack of acidity does not mean basicity. It just means the hydrogen doesn't want to come off. Just because a hydrogen doesn't want to come off doesn't mean the compound wants to pull another hydrogen towards it. Now, any other questions of any kind related to SN2 before we now move into SN1? Yes?
Can the nucleophile be the substrate itself?
Can the nucleophile be the substrate itself? Yes. Which we'll see let me just show you a use of something like that. Something that you don't learn until next quarter, but you could understand it now. If you use sodium hydride, NaH, hydride tends not to be very nucleophilic, but it is very basic. And what could happen is an H minus could pull off a proton from a molecule like this, an alcohol. If it did that, though, that will generate what's known as an alkoxide. Negatively charged ion that can be produced from an alcohol. That alkoxide could then swing around and attack and kick off the bromine that's one position over from it. Ends up forming a molecule called an epoxide. So that is an intramolecular SN2. And it is a trick often used to create epoxides. There's another reagent that you'll learn this quarter to make an epoxide. But to answer your question, yes, there are some circumstances where the substrate is the nucleophile, but only in this kind of case where it ends up being intramolecular. Other questions? Then let's get to SN1 reactions. And let's do a mechanism for the SN1 reaction. I'm going to use a halogen as the leaving group and a halogen as the nucleophile. Actually, no, I'm not. Because I showed you one particular leaving group that I'm quite fond of. If you haven't been with me long enough as an instructor, when I say I'm quite fond of, that means shows up in problems. All right. Besides halogens, besides bromine, chlorine, and iodine, which let's remind ourselves, why is fluorine a poor leaving group? Because of the conjugate base of a weak acid. Fluoride's basic, which is why it's a good nucleophile. Now, saying it's a good nucleophile does not automatically mean it's a bad leaving group, so don't confuse that. But fluoride is a poor leaving group because it wants to just hold on to that carbon that it's bound to. But what's some other non-halogen leaving group that I had discussed last time? Sulfonates. So in fact, let me give you some specific example of these sulfonates. And this is not connected with SN1 at the moment. This can happen, this could be the substrate for an SN2 reaction as well, depending on what R is. But I just want you to have been shown these specific leaving groups. This is an alkyl para toluene sulfonate. So you might remember from the "you can't believe how bad humor it was" that we had the other day about paradox and the ortho and meta that went along with it. But because of that horrible moment seared into your memory, hopefully you remember, therefore, that this is para. So para toluene. Toluene is benzene with a methyl group on it. So you can identify the toluene portion of it, but it's got a substituent on it as well. So this much is toluene, one of the most mispronounced words in chemistry. Even myself, if I'm not careful, I'll say toluene. Toluene is what comes out, but it's toluene, just like nuclear and nuclear. One of those is right and one of them is not. Para toluene sulfonate, having the S with three oxygens on it, that turns it into a sulfonate functional group. This thing comes off super easily. In fact, this is often a better leaving group than even the halogens are. Why? Because once it comes off, you make an ion that's got all kinds of resonance in it. I mean, that's partly why sulfuric acid itself is so acidic. In fact, realize that if I substitute the toluene with an OH group, then this is sulfuric acid that we would have, or something structurally similar to it. Sulfuric acid, incredibly strong acid. Sulfonate or sulfate, either one, ions that therefore are not at all basic, really, and perfectly comfortable being ions in solution. So that makes it an excellent leaving group. Instead of going around and saying para toluene sulfonate, though, there's a short name for it: tosylate. There's its close cousin, methane sulfonate. So this is an alkyl methane sulfonate. Some of you who are particularly observant, you might say, wait, methane instead of methyl? Yeah, it's this little subtle rule that happens because we're sticking two functional groups together, an alkane and a sulfonate. So if it dissociated, it would also make something pretty stable. Again, similar reasons, all kinds of resonance. Remember that we had a discussion earlier in the quarter that you have not been quizzed or tested on yet. Remember that we had a discussion earlier in the quarter that you have not been quizzed or tested on yet, as far as what can make compounds more acidic. We didn't have that question on the exam, did we? Where I put methanol or ethanol and acetic acid and asked why is one more acidic than the other? Yeah, but you're going to get that question. So what were the effects that we discussed? I just mentioned one of them a few minutes ago, in fact, about hybridization. What are two other effects that can affect acidity? So that's the hybridization aspect. What else? Inductive effect, which means you've got an electronegative group somewhere else in the molecule that's pulling electrons towards it, which means whatever's connected to it comes off more easily. What's the other effect? Resonance, that if what you produce, like this ends up having a lot of resonance, it makes it easier to make. That's also part of the reason why this ion comes off so easily. You could even just make a resonance argument. But resonance won't occur, not productive resonance, until the dissociation happens.
Only three.
Those are the three effects we discussed, yes. Hybridization, inductive effect, and resonance. So, the short name for this, mesylate. So tosylates and mesylates. Just to show you why is this such an important group, or why is this such a common thing, again, something that you're going to see next quarter, but you might as well be familiar with at least now, is you can react an alcohol with a molecule whose short name is tosyl chloride. And without getting into the mechanism, just pretend that chlorine's a leaving group and that an alcohol for this molecule ends up being nucleophilic enough it can displace the chlorine. That's not an SN1 reaction, it's not an SN2 reaction. I'm just trying to take what you do know so far and try to give you some hand-waving explanation what happens. Sulfur here, you can imagine, is super, 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 super duper delta positive, because it's got two oxygens and the chlorine all hooked up to it. And so it makes it really attractive for the alcohol to attack, even if the alcohol's not negatively charged. So the end result of these two compounds reacting is a tosylate, which let me show you now this abbreviation. OTS. The TS stands for the rest of this portion of the structure. There are actually several groups of dozens of them in organic chemistry that organic chemists get tired of writing down all the time, and so they abbreviate. So TS, notice it doesn't include that last oxygen that's connecting over. But TS can be used as a legitimate abbreviation for the rest of it. Just like I know this is out of order, but so is my brain this morning. Notice the abbreviations I just made here. For ethanol, ET, methanol, ME, propanol, PR, butanol, BU. Notice that in the same way as I did with the tosylate, these abbreviations don't include that oxygen itself. By extension, then, I could use ET to mean ethyl anywhere. I can use amine to mean methyl anywhere. And you probably have already seen that in your text. I just haven't commented on it before. It's such a, not unimportant, but a small detail that in our grand scheme of things just hadn't come to my mind to present yet. But I should have presented this a bit earlier. Max, you had a question?
Answered it.
Okay. Well, this is enough about compounds. Why don't we get to the SN1 reaction? The reason we got off on this tangent is because I wanted to show you an SN1 reaction that did not involve three steps. Because when I first showed you the SN1 reaction earlier in the quarter in lab, we had an alcohol as our nucleophile. But alcohols, when they make new bonds, start out positively charged. And so there's this last step of deprotonation that happens when you have an alcohol. Not always true in SN1 reaction. And if I'm trying to make sure that you clearly know what an SN1 reaction is, that's why I want to show you an example that does not involve an alcohol. So let's say I have mesylate, and I react it with something like sodium iodide. You might say, okay, now wait a minute, iodide, isn't that negatively charged? Yes, it is, but it's not basic. So this is one of those crossover cases. All the rest of the nucleophiles that we're going to see for SN1 reactions are actually going to be poor nucleophiles. And there's a reason for that that I'll show you after the mechanism. So what can occur here is that since we have a tertiary position, this can go ahead and form a carbocation. Why? Because you get more extensive hyperconjugation in this carbocation than you ever could with a primary or a secondary. So when we come back to these four factors again of substrate, nucleophile, leaving group, and solvent, we're going to have the opposite substrate effect that we had here for the SN2 reaction. So you form that carbocation. If there is iodide floating around in solution, it could now come into attack. You might ask, well, doesn't that mean that maybe the reaction go backwards? Could iodine pop back off? Yes, but sulfonates are not good nucleophiles. So this reaction is likely to go in the forward direction. And the only reason I'm really showing you this example for the moment is so now I could write a reaction coordinate diagram for this. Overall, let's say that the reaction is exothermic. There's going to be an intermediate, though, that's higher in energy than either the reactant or the product, because you're making a carbocation, you're breaking a bond. That first step, in fact, is the more difficult step of the reaction, and so it's going to have the larger activation barrier, then a smaller activation barrier to continue on to the product. Let's try to draw, because we did it for SN2 reaction, let's draw transition state structures for the two transition states in this reaction. You already seen the mechanism up above, and I tried to communicate this warning last lecture that normally in writing a mechanism, you don't worry about the structure of a transition state. But we're just worrying about it in this case so we can get into discussing certain aspects of the reaction. So transition state one, what would it look like? Well, energetically, it's closer to the intermediate, which is the carbocation. So it's going to look kind of like the carbocation, except that we'll have still part of the bond to the original leaving group. Now, I didn't write this abbreviation up above, but MS is the same as mesyl, which is where mesylate comes from. That's transition state one. What would transition state two look like? Again, it would look mostly like the carbocation because the transition state is closer in energy to the carbocation. So in this case, it doesn't really give us that much information. The SN2 case, the transition state structure, could be a part of our way of rationalizing why inversion of configuration occurs for SN2. But for SN1, we have a completely different stereochemical result, which to try to put some structure to this discussion, let's review the six aspects of this SN1 reaction. What is its utility? Same as SN2, to convert an alkyl halide to one of a number of functional groups, most common ones of which will be alcohols and ethers. What are the reagents? Normally, we use weak, non-basic nucleophiles. Now, we're going to have a lecture where we'll talk about extensively why does SN1 versus SN2 happen. Because we're going to come to the point in just a moment where I say that secondary substrates work for SN1 reactions. But SN2 reactions can also happen for secondary substrates. So if I give you a secondary substrate and a reagent, you will eventually need to be able to recognize, ooh, okay, that reagent, that's hydroxide, that's basic, that's a strong nucleophile, that's going to make SN2 happen. Or, ooh, here's water, not a base, not a great nucleophile, not powerful enough to push a leaving group off, and so it has to wait for a carbocation to form. That's actually why you need non-basic weak nucleophiles for an SN1 reaction. Because if you have a really reactive reagent, it won't wait for a carbocation. It'll try to do some other reaction. It's only if the reagent itself is not reactive that it can wait around for the carbocation to form. Then once it forms, ooh, there's that positive charge it would want to chase. And then the reaction begins. So we need weak, non-basic nucleophiles so that the carbocation has a chance to form. What about the conditions? Well, the conditions have to do with the solvent, and usually we use protic solvents. In fact, the solvent is usually the nucleophile. What about the mechanism? We've got that right up above. What about stereochemistry? That will I'll show on the next page, but to summarize, you have loss of configuration. What about regiochemistry? Well, technically, if we have a carbocation intermediate, that means we have hydride shifts that are possible. Yes?
So, as far as stereochemistry, SN1 is loss of configuration, and SN2 is inversion?
Correct. Right. Now, why is SN1? I'm sorry, question. Hydride shift, methyl shift are kind of the same effect. We haven't seen a methyl shift yet, but we will soon. Better way of general of saying it, carbocation rearrangement. So let's look at the stereochemistry question. And I know that we reviewed this in that lecture a long time ago, but this is our formal introduction. So, if I had some tertiary center that was chiral, and if I allowed the leaving group to leave, yes, I am. Sorry, I should put that label up here. Make a carbocation that is sp2 hybridized and planar. Since the geometry of the carbocation the important intermediate is planar, attack of the nucleophile can occur from either side, producing two products. So to continue that example, if I had a tertiary alkyl halide and I reacted it with a nucleophile like ethanol, a weak nucleophile, not negatively charged, still has a lone pair on the oxygen, still has an oxygen that's delta negative. It may not be negatively charged, but it's delta negative. So it'll react. If I don't include the mechanism, if I just show the products, Here are the two products that will result. Now, if we form the products in 50-50 mixture, what is that called? Racemic. This reaction will not always make a racemic mixture. So if both products form in equal proportions, the mixture will be optically inactive. Because it is racemic. But it won't always happen that it'll be 50-50. Even in a case like this where there's not much around the carbocation to influence the reaction. Now, when you read over racemic mixtures, did anybody happen to read why they don't always form? And I know it's been a couple weeks now since we did stereochemistry, so can't say I blame you if you don't remember. It's actually back to the solvent, the effect of a solvent. Because imagine this, carbocation forms, the ion comes off. But what if the solvent surrounding that pair of ions keeps the ions somewhat associated with each other? So in other words, the bond breaks, but the ion doesn't just go off into solution. It kind of hovers right there with the molecule. That's called an ion pair. So they're ions, but they're paired up at the same time. So they're not bonded, but they're not separate either. Well, if you have an ion that's floating above the reaction site, the carbocation, then that ion itself can block incoming molecules, making attack from the other side slightly more likely. Now, since it is dissociated, it's not that the ion is permanently there blocking the approach. So the ion can move over and the molecule can come into attack. So you'll get two products, but you won't get 50-50. Maybe you'll get 60-40 or something like that. So it could be skewed a little bit. So you still produce two products, but you don't end up with a racemic mixture. So if both products form in equal proportion, the mixture will be optically inactive, which is because it's racemic. However, after dissociation, ions can sometimes form ion pairs in solution. When this occurs, one side of the carbocation in this reaction would be somewhat blocked. So imagine this, we have a plane, let's say we have our molecule to be attacked in it. Here's our p orbital, and here is the ion floating around above it. So again, this attack is slightly more likely from below.
What's preventing the DR to go from below also?
Because the bromine can only come off the direction it used to be connected to. So that bromine bond is going to break with the bromine coming off, not going into the molecule. So bromine's only going to dissociate to one side. That leaves the other side more open. Question? Actually, I haven't even shown the structure of the solvent yet. But it is often protic solvents that are used for SN1 reactions. Or ethanol. Ethanol is the nucleophile in this reaction, so we make it the solvent. No, ethanol is protic. Because it has these easily hydrogen-bonded protons. And when I said something is not acidic, I should have qualified that and said that if hydroxide is such a common nucleophile, then aprotic really means something even less acidic than water, because hydroxide otherwise could easily deprotonate the solvent. So let me just wrap this up. When this occurs, this meaning that the ion pair forms, one side of the carbocation would be somewhat blocked, which would result in a mixture with two products, but not in exactly equal proportion. Oh, darn. So I ran out of time again. So we'll have to go over our four aspects, our four factors: substrate, nucleophile, leaving group, and solvent next time. Our discussion is going to be pretty short, though, because nucleophile, what makes a good nucleophile for SN2, it's the same thing for SN1. What makes a good leaving group for SN2 is exactly the same thing for SN1. So what really we need to address is the substrate and solvent. So we'll do that first right away on Friday.